Welcome to Community Alert. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams, keeping you informed on how to get ready and be prepared. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.
Hey, folks, welcome to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're going to be talking with Ronnie Coleman, who is a California State Fire Marshal retired, talking about the Fire Marshal's office and some of the things that are involved there. We're having a little trouble getting through to him, but we'll be with him in just a second. Yeah. Mike, do you want to?
Apparently, they're working on the phones in Sacramento, so we'll be with him in just a second. Starting off with a couple of important PSAs from Santa Barbara County Fire Department. Fireworks are illegal in Santa Barbara County. Santa Barbara County Fire Department reminds the public that all fireworks, are including the so-called self-insane variety, are illegal in all areas of Santa Barbara County. However, some cities within Santa Barbara County have local rules regarding fireworks within their local jurisdictions. Each 4th of July, thousands of people, most often children and teenagers, are injured while using fireworks. An average of 32,000 fires occur, with 9,300 injuries resulting from fireworks nationally, according to the National Fire Protection Agency. Despite the dangers of fireworks, people fail to understand that associated risks, devastating burns, injuries, fires, and even death can occur. Again, fireworks illegal everywhere in Santa Barbara County. For further information, you can visit sbcfire.com. That's sbcfire.com, or give them a call at 681-5530, 681-5530. And I think fireworks are okay in Santa Maria and Lompoc. Inside the city limits.
But only within the city limits. And if you go outside the city limits, you'll get in trouble.
Absolutely. And also from Santa Barbara County Fire, the burn ban begins today. And that means no burning anywhere. I think that's pretty self-explanatory. Due to California's projected increase in fire activity, coupled with record-setting drought conditions, requires Santa Barbara County Fire Department to take every step possible to prevent new wildfires from starting. In order to reduce potential ignitions and to support the declaration of drought emergency in Santa Barbara County, the governor's drought state of emergency declaration has prompted the Santa Barbara County Fire Department to suspend all burning permits effective July 1. Again, further information available at sbcfire.com.
Ron's on the line.
And Ron Coleman, welcome to the show.
Hi there. I'm sorry we're having problems with the phone connection this morning.
Well, that's okay. We're just putting out the announcement here. No fireworks in Santa Barbara County. As former state fire marshal, I know fireworks was probably one of your greatest nemesis.
Fireworks, as far as most people are concerned, is like setting off explosions in your front yard that you would not want anybody else doing, but we do it once a year to celebrate the 4th.
Well, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule, Chief, to visit with us today. A question that comes up frequently about our show and meetings that we go to is, who is the fire marshal? What is the fire marshal? Where do they come from? What are their authority? What's their background? Why do they have so much influence in construction today? Those kinds of questions keep popping up, so I figure there's no greater authority on the issue in the United States than you. So we thought we'd dive into that today.
Well, you know, this idea of a fire marshal as a position or as a title is not exactly a modern concept. The idea of somebody in a fire department being responsible for fire prevention and making sure that buildings are built according to standards and that occupancies are safe and so forth goes all the way back to the turn of the century when fire departments were struggling with major catastrophes around the country. Many fire departments started differentiating between the fire chief, who is the person who's responsible for the overall operation of a community, with the fire marshal, whose job it was to focus on the buildings themselves. Quite frankly, hardly anybody ever enters the fire service with the idea that they'll someday be the fire marshal. But the fact of the matter is that it's a job title that is extremely responsible and extremely accountable. And as a matter of fact, the fire marshal, in my opinion, who is actually the person who is responsible for creating or eliminating the fire problem in a community.
Well, when you look at the job description of fire marshal, what all falls under their privy?
A whole bunch of things, such as enforcement of the state fire codes and the city fire codes, building plan checks, and permitting processes and monitoring different things that are going on in the community and so forth. And for all intents and purposes, the job description of a fire marshal focuses on the fire problem as opposed to the suppression of those fire problems. It also includes having some expertise in what we call risk mitigation, meaning the use of smoke detectors, sprinklers, compartmentalization, things like that.
Mm-hmm. So the background of the fire marshal is considerably different than that of somebody that's strictly focused on suppression issues?
Very definitely. And I'm not saying that fire suppression people don't migrate into the fire marshal's job, because that is very true in many fire departments. I can actually recall a point in time in which spending time in the Fire Prevention Bureau was a necessary thing to do if you ever wanted to be a fire chief. But the reality is that particular job is differentiated from the operations section in that it's very proactive and focused a lot on mitigation of things rather than responding to them.
You know, and in my travels, not just with you, but throughout for a decade now, I've noticed that there seems to be some differences in the fire marshals within large organizations and the small districts and what have you. Is that really true, or is it pretty much the same?
Well, it's true, and at the same time, it depends. Let me see if I can be real specific. Generally speaking, the fire marshal of a very large community, let's use the word metropolitan community, cities that are very highly dense and ones that are very complex in their nature, the fire marshal is a pretty high up level position in the hierarchy of that organization. And they have to be very, very well qualified in the decision-making processes and understanding local codes and national codes and so on and so forth. Smaller communities, in fact, there are many very small communities that don't even have what they call a fire marshal. They may have a fire inspector or two. And then, of course, you get into the volunteer fire service where there's hardly any fire prevention functionality. There are exceptions to that rule, too. For example, Tenley Park in the Midwest is a fire department that's mostly fire prevention, and it's still a volunteer fire department. So the functionality and the scope and sizability of the fire prevention problem varies considerably. Smaller communities, it's not uncommon for the fire chief to maintain the position of being the fire marshal at the same time you're fire chief.
Yeah, one of my arguments is that for volunteer organizations, fire prevention really needs to be the number one priority. And in some organizations, that in fact is true. But for the most part, they like to focus on the suppression side, because that's where the fun is.
Yeah.
But when we look at the issue of codes, that's where the fire marshal, I think, pops into the mind of most folks. How does that relationship work? The fire marshal doesn't create the codes for the most part. They're charged with enforcing them. That puts them in an interesting position.
Well, there's a wide variety of roles that a fire marshal plays. Let's talk about the concept of how codes were adopted in the first place. In the United States right now, we have what's called a family of codes, fire code, building code, plumbing code, et cetera, published by the ICC, International Code Council. These codes are promulgated on a periodic basis, and then they're distributed out to the states, where states have two choices. One is called a mini-maxi state. The other is called a local control state. And in a mini-maxi state, the codes that are adopted by the state apply to the local jurisdiction without amendment, meaning they can't add or detract from the code. Local control states, on the other hand, their state can adopt those set of codes, but then they have the ability to make modifications based on local conditions. These are called findings of fact. And so a fire marshal has to be very, very familiar with what kind of a structure their state has with regard to code enforcement, statutory responsibilities, and so forth. And if they're a local control state, they have to be prepared to amend the code to deal with whatever local issues they're confronted with.
Well, it gets to be quite a challenge, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit about that. I wanted to get your website information out. Chief Coleman's one of the most prolific writers on the fire service in the United States today and has been for decades. A lot of his writing's now available at no charge at cafsti.net/ Table Talk. That's CAFSTI.net/Table Talk. And we'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. But lots and lots of information out there on this and many other subjects. As we get to talking with Chief Coleman today, former California State Fire Marshal, on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster, with Ted Adams, Mike Williams, Richard Ugin on the slide pots on KZSB AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio. We'll be right back.
Folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're talking with Ronnie Coleman, California State Fire Marshal, retired, about the Fire Marshal's Office, what it does, how it affects us all, and some insights into all things in that area.
Well,
Mike.
Well, Chief, let's get into the issue of building codes and the areas in which the Fire Marshal has authority, whether it be at the local level or at the state level. Back in the day, there were no codes on how things were built for the most part, and a lot of those buildings are still standing today. And yet today, if you try to do anything, you're inundated with codes, policies, procedures, local ordinance, and on it goes. How have we evolved into where we are today, and what's the necessity for some of this?
Well, it's been a awfully long journey. First off, you have to know that the concept of having a building code, believe it or not, goes all the way back to the reign of King Hammurabi. Back in the early days of development of civilization, he came up with a set of rules. One of them I thought was particularly humorous is, if a builder built a house and the house collapsed and killed the owner, then the state executed the architect. Kind of, and to me, that's a pretty heavy penalty. But the fact of the matter is, fire and building codes have evolved almost continuously over time. I would characterize the first couple of thousand years of development as strictly being pragmatic things like making sure the buildings didn't fall down arbitrarily and that they didn't present a danger to their occupants. The modern version of all this starts about 1840, 1850, somewhere around there, with the work of a fellow by the name of John Damrell, who at the time was the chief of the Boston Fire Department. And John witnessed the Great Chicago Fire in 1871 and had written a letter to his city council saying, we need some kind of code to make sure the buildings are built adequately, that roofs are properly designed, and the distance between buildings is taken care of, and so forth. So the concept of creating a code got its start right about that time frame. It started evolving through the insurance industry getting involved. The American Insurance Association once published a model building code and a model fire code, et cetera. And it's continued to evolve for two reasons. One is the fact that buildings are getting bigger and bigger and taller and taller. We all recognize that with the influx of growth and development in our communities. And as these processes have become more and more sophisticated, organizations have made different attempts to codify that. And what I mean by codify is to put it in writing so that everybody knew what the ground rules were. It might be helpful to characterize two different types of things that have gone on. One is the development of a code. And what a code means is a series of statements adopted by an authority having jurisdiction and say, this is what we want to see done in our communities. Limits to the size of buildings, number of exits that are in them, types of exits, and so forth. Then there's another document called a standard. And what a standard is the how to do that. A good example of how I might clarify that is the code might say, if you're going to build a building this way, then you've got to sprinkler it. But you have to go to the NFPA to find out where the standards are on how to sprinkle a building of that type. So we play in two different worlds. One is a world of statutory requirements and adopting a code that applies to our community. And then we use standards that are consensus documents that everybody agrees that's the how-to. Now, this may sound difficult, and at times it is, but that's one of the roles of the fire marshal, is to be sitting in the driver's seat of all that.
Well, extending into that, who are some of the organizations that are so intimately involved in the code process? It's more than just the fire service. There's many other players involved.
Well, first off, we shouldn't limit this discussion to strictly the fire marshal. There's another key player in most communities, and that's the building official. The building official does the building code, and the fire official does the fire code. We used to have kind of a standing joke is that the building code was used to stand the building up, and the fire code was used to keep it from burning down. And the two of them are hand in glove. They interface consistently. Now, the organizations are involved in this. We don't have enough time to list all of them because we'll be on this call for the next 45 minutes. But there are a couple of real key players. One of the first ones in the code arena is the International Code Council, known as the ICC. They're pretty much the nationwide consensus code development group right now. And they are influenced by other groups, such as National Association of State Fire Marshals, International Association of Fire Chiefs, and their subgroups on fire and life safety codes. Then there is the standard side, and a lot of that comes from the National Fire Protection Association, as well as the American Society of Testing and Materials, commonly known as ASTM. Then at the state level, many states have building commissions, and many states have state fire marshals. And these people interface with this adoption and implementation process.
So where does the codes come in from different perspectives? People decide there's a new requirement, something's occurred, we need to get a code to deal with that, or maybe the codes are out of line with practical reality today. How long does the process take to make those kinds of amendments and changes?
Well, let's talk about the code itself. And what I mean by the code itself, I'm talking about fire and building codes. They are revised on a cyclic basis. Currently, I believe, and I'm actually embarrassed that I don't actually remember this, but I think it's a three-year cycle or a four-year cycle, and I've forgotten temporarily because I've been retired now for 10 years, and I forgot. But the uniform and international codes are, they have conferences where they come together and talk about changes to these codes on a periodic basis. During that cycle period, code recommendations are made by anybody. I mean, a John Q. Citizen walking down the street can make a code recommended change, but it will be debated and extensively discussed by both fire and building people to make sure that it's consistent with the code.
Well, you know, I've done enough construction defect cases that I can appreciate that not only are there code standards, but there's also the practices of the industries and what actually gets done in the field. And the three don't necessarily agree with each other. And it makes for some interesting, challenging conversations from time to time as we try to get everybody to go in the same direction, does it not?
Yep. The reason for this uniformity and consistency is the fact that let's just use kind of an arbitrary situation. Let's go to Orange County, California, or someplace like Prince George's County, Maryland, where urbanization sprawls all over the place. And you can drive down the street, and you're probably have to be a native to know which town you're in, because there is no distinction. But a builder building on one side of the street and a builder building on the other side of the street, sometimes, and in the past, they have faced different sets of requirements. This causes an economic impact on the building industry that is significant. So by coming up with these international codes and coming up with uniformity, we level the playing field for code adoption and enforcement. That way, organizations that are attempting to build, let's say, in multiple locations, have a much better chance of having uniformity in what they're being asked to do. This, by the way, is not necessarily an American phenomena. I have been involved in what they refer to as the EU project, going back clear to the 1980s, where the Europeans faced this idea of uniformity a long time ago, too, and they started coming up with standardized fire and building codes. So it's a phenomena of modern times that we need uniformity to balance out the economic interests of construction and development.
Well, hold that thought. We're up to our next break. Speaking of uniformity, Ted Adams, Mike Williams on Community Alert, live on the internet at newspress.com. This is KZSB AM 1290. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. Today we're visiting with Ronnie Coleman, who's California State Fire Marshal, retired, talking about the office that he was involved with for many years and is still involved, actually, in retirement, and just getting into the whole aspect of what that's all about, what the Fire Marshal Office does.
Let's get into two other players that are in the code process, and that would be the industry insurance companies, whether that be for the property owners or the contractors in general, and the manufacturers, the companies that manufacture construction project materials. How much do they play into it, and what kind of conflicts does that kind of create? Because obviously they have a bit of a moral hazard of sorts.
Well, when we talk about fire prevention, one of the things I should have mentioned under the historical aspect is the person that we often point to as being the father of two of those industries is the same guy.
Yep.
And that happens to be Benjamin Franklin, supposedly the first quote-unquote American. He was heavily involved in the insurance industry by researching and utilizing techniques that were employed in England. And then he was very heavily involved in the creation of the first fire departments. You might remember an infamous quote that Ben had in the Poor Richard's Almanac. It went something like, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Okay? He applied that to a whole bunch of things, but specifically when it comes to talking about fire, there is a direct correlation between the level of fire protection in a community and the interests of the insurance industry from a standpoint of fire loss. Back in the early days, as a matter of fact, many people are familiar with the idea called fire marks, where insurance companies used to put metal signs on the outside of buildings and say, oh boy, if this house is on fire, do everything you can to save it because we'll reimburse you for your time. Of course, that practice has gone by the wayside back in the early 1800s, but today we have a huge insurance industry and an extensive code development process, and the manufacturers are doing everything they can to make a buck in terms of building buildings, so they try to make them lighter, less expensive, all those kinds of economic interests. The insurance industry tries to evaluate what risk they're taking. And then the fire department is trying to reduce that risk as much as we possibly can. I jokingly refer to it as a merry-go-round. We're all holding hands going in a circle. if we don't pay attention to building materials, we get into specific fire problems that we're not prepared for. If we don't control those materials, limit the environment that they work in, the insurance industry takes a bath with losses. That makes sense?
Sure. Well, there has to be balance in the process.
It's all got to be balanced out, and moreover, it's got to be intertwined with the element of time. One thing I constantly remind people is that their city is not a static building fire problem. They got some buildings that are 100 years old, and they got some that are 8 hours old. And you got to have an approach that deals with both.
When we look at the codes today, what are some of the more significant fire issues that we're dealing with? I know lightweight construction comes up. Some of the new forms of insulation are an issue. From your point of view, what are the big ticket issues?
Oh, boy, we got lots of big ticket issues. One of the big issues going on today has to do with sprinkler protection as to where that is ultimately going to go. For over 125, 150 years, we've been really limiting the fire problem in industrial and commercial through the use of sprinklers. And over about the last 25, or close to 30 now, we've been applying that same technology in multi-homes, multi-family housing, and single-family housing, and we are significantly changing the fire problem. But that's a battlefield between us and other interests that do not want to see that occur. We've got issues right now about building materials in terms of how they react under fire conditions. I'm not going to name any specifics for purposes of this program, but almost everything that is being proposed to build a building out of has some sort of consequence. I, for example, in my lifetime, have seen houses built out of spare tires. I've seen houses built out of straw bales. I've seen houses built out of plastic, et cetera, et cetera. And some of these issues are finding their way into the codes. At the same time, new risk mitigation is finding itself into the codes. And therein lies the complexity of it all.
Ronnie, I think another area that maybe you could talk a little bit about is the wildland-urban interface area and how that's affecting the codes.
Oh, my goodness. Well, as you know, we've done radio shows on the urban-wildland interface already, and I might refer the listeners back to some of those previous broadcasts between myself and Kate Dargan. But what we talk when we talk about the urban-wildland interface, this is my opinion, by the way, and this is not an opinion that everybody will necessarily agree with, but the urban-wildland interface, the fire problem has not changed. Putting people in the way of the fire problem is what's happened. Go back to 1910, worst fire year in the history of the United States when the Forest Service was created. We burnt the living bee daylights out of the western United States, and we burnt a bunch of mining towns off the face of the earth. Now you go back into that same area, and you've got cities of 100,000 people living in the direct path of a volatile fire problem. The urban-wildland interface is not going to go away. As a matter of fact, I'm anticipating that with the complexity of drought and poor land use policies, it's going to get worse.
Yep, I think you're right.
Well, you mentioned the video that we did, Wildfire Past, Present, and Future, with yourself and former State Fire Marshal Kate Dargan, available at wildlandresidents.org under the Community Alert tag there on the left-hand side. It's about an hour-long video that we did. Very, very informative for folks that'd like to know about the history of wildfire. It starts off with the 1910 fires, quite a bit of video from 1910. That was a great program. Again, available at wildlandresidents.org. Under Community Alert. Another area where the State Fire Marshal's Office in particular plays a big part, and it gets into the code issue, is not only with building construction, but what goes inside buildings and for manufacturing and whatever. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, there's some issues that are coming to the forefront today, for example, regarding the toxicity of fire retardant chemicals themselves. We've been attempting to reduce fire spread and flame spread in building materials, specifically mattresses and over and upholstered furniture and so on and so forth. And now there's contention among the scientists that that the burning of those materials is putting chemicals into the atmosphere that are very, I would use the word significant, in terms of causing other kinds of problems. So control over the flammability of contents. There's a fellow by the name of Dan Madrakowski, works for the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who's been doing a huge amount of fire protection research on flame spread as it relates to the condition we commonly call flashover, about how fast does a small fire turn into an unsurvivable fire. And all of these are issues associated with the contents of how a material is fabricated, how it's assembled, and then how it's utilized. I would characterize this as probably as just about as significant as the size of buildings is what we put in them and how we control what we put in them.
Well, I know one of the challenges that I see when I go around to different buildings on assessments is that the way the building was originally built is not what's in there today. They move walls, they tilt up things, the cubicle offices have come in, sprinkler placement that was designed and engineered does not necessarily equate to what's in the building now. There's not a lot we can do about that, is there?
Well, of course, there is something that can be done about it, and that is the reason for a Fire Prevention Bureau in the first place. Fire Prevention Bureau's primary interest is to make sure the building's built correct. We call that plan checking and certificate of occupancy, that you're in charge of making sure that building's ready to go the minute you give the key to the occupant. Second is what we refer to as ongoing inspections, and it includes a component called tenant improvements, where we go out and look at things when people are doing them properly and under permits and so forth. And then secondarily, catching people doing dumb stuff like that. We haven't got enough time on this show to tell war stories, but I will tell one time that was so severe that I actually had to shut a business down that was owned by my own mayor because they had engaged in such an egregious breaching of the code. And so it's a dual responsibility for a fire prevention bureau to catch those kinds of things. There's a concept called change of occupancy. And if you have a building built for a specific purpose and then you change occupancy, let's say that building is sprinklered and you sprinkled it under ordinary risk and then you put a high-risk occupancy in it, you got to do something with the sprinklers.
Yeah. Well, hold that thought. When we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about fireworks. Visiting today with former State Fire Marshal Ronnie J. Coleman on Community Alert. Ted Adams, Mike Williams. We'll be back in just a moment on KZSB AM 1290.
Folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. Today we're talking to Ronnie Coleman, California State Fire Marshal, retired, about the office and what it does in the state and how it affects all of us.
Let's get into the issue of fireworks, Chief. I read at the beginning of the show Captain Sadecki's notice about fireworks in Santa Barbara County being illegal. My impression is that's probably the single greatest problem for fire chiefs and fire marshals in the state of California is fireworks. Am I right?
I'm afraid I won't agree that it's the single greatest problem. I would say that it belongs in the panoply of other issues, but I don't consider it the top one. We just got done talking about the urban wildland interface. To me, that's a biggie.
Yeah, for sure. Well, why is fireworks such a problem? I don't think the public as a whole have any idea the complexity of fireworks.
Well, let's talk about the nature of fireworks in the first place. There are two types of fireworks, legal ones and illegal ones. The legal ones in California are labeled safe and sane. A lot of people argue with that title because what the hell does safe and sane mean when you're setting fire to something? The issue is that fireworks that are considered legal in California are those fireworks that fly through the air or go bang, they explode. Those are illegal fireworks. Legal safe and sane firework may put out sparks, it may put out different kinds of smoke conditions and so forth, but they have gone through a testing protocol which says that they meet a certain minimum criteria. Illegal fireworks is a significant problem because illegal fireworks are what often are direct results in injury to people and or direct fire loss. Have you ever heard the term M80?
Oh, yeah, we had them in high school.
Well, I tell you what, an M80 can blow your fingers off. I mean, I've seen that. I've seen kids who've lost hands as a result of their daddy gives them an M80 and say, here, hang on to it for the last minute and then throw it. Well, they hold on to it for 2 seconds too long and bam, they're no longer left-handed. The issue is that the illegal fireworks that are imported into our state, I'm going to talk about our state specifically. I'm not going to talk about the other 49. In our state, the illegal fireworks create a mask for the use of fireworks in general. In other words, I've driven down streets that looks like battle zones on the 4th of July. Any private citizen who utilizes an illegal firework of that nature is endangering the life and property of their family, their neighbor, and their community, because there's no way you can control the reaction of an exploding device or a device that flies through the air. Am I making sense?
Oh, absolutely. So when we look at the how much problem are we talking about as far as volume goes? I look in the paper, there have been some significant seizures of fireworks just in the last 30 days down in the greater Los Angeles area.
This is a bigger problem than the average citizen who doesn't really think about this knows about. We don't usually confiscate illegal fireworks like one and two at a time. I'm speaking when I was fire marshal, and that was over a decade ago, but we would sometimes capture garages full of illegal fireworks. We would capture semis loaded with illegal fireworks. We're not talking about onesies and twosies here. We're talking about a collection of raw materials that can be really an endangerment. Now, here's the dilemma that the fire service faces. When you get that stuff, think about it for just a second. You used to be a police officer out there, Mike, and you know that if you confiscate something, what do you got to do with it? Got to keep it.
I got to keep it. I've got to tag it. I got to store it. And then at some point, I got to dispose of it.
That's correct. Now, think about the cost of that disposal. So illegal fireworks are a double danger to the community. First off, they are creating the fire problem and the danger to injury and fire loss. And simultaneously, when they're captured, they create a huge financial burden on local government for having to store that stuff. So it's a double-edged sword. But I used to say the best thing that we could do to stop illegal fireworks was to let people realize that it's their taxpayers' money that's going to have to pay for that that destruction.
When where is the most prominent source of the illegal fireworks? Is it the internet? Is it Nevada? Is it shipments on the internet out of China? Where are we seeing most of it come from?
I can't answer that question today because I have no idea what's really going on with the industry. I don't talk to the ABI guy, arson bomb guys, all that much anymore. But I would say that every one of those is a contributor. There are people who are receiving fireworks through the postal services, which, in my opinion, is a misuse of the postal system. And yet others take a drive somewhere and buy them and cross state line.
Mm-hmm. You'd think the Postal Service would be looking for things like that just because of all the other options that are out there with people shipping explosive materials through the mail.
Well, it's not quite that simple, but I agree with you. The surveillance and the elimination of the illegal fire problem is the number one step. Now, I'm not going to argue the case about whether safe or sane fireworks are good or bad for the community other than to say that that's the law now. Mm-hmm. And as that law is processed and we evaluate impact of things, the absolute necessity is to eliminate the illegal ones.
Well, very good.
How about eliminating the desire to purchase fireworks? That would be the ultimate solution.
Well, the problem you got there, Guy, is the fact that a significant number of our nonprofits locally use fireworks sales to fund their other altruistic projects.
Mm.
There are many of our, in fact, I actually know volunteer fire departments who sell fireworks to support their fire department.
Sure.
Even though it's illegal.
No, it's not illegal.
No, okay.
In California, safe and sane, we're a local control state. So mm-hmm. we've got a law regarding safe and sane. However, local jurisdictions can declare all fireworks illegal.
Right.
Now, that's the difference. I heard you mention Captain So-and-so a few minutes ago. What was his name again?
Sadecki. He's the PIO at San Bernardino
County. What he's saying is that his community or his county has outlawed them, and that then makes both safe and sane and illegal fireworks illegal in that community.
Right. Mm.
Period.
They can't be sold or discharged.
And, of course, one of the areas that they're most concerned about is the bottle rockets.
Of course they are, because the bottle rockets, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there is no such thing as a legal bottle rocket in California that flies through the air.
No, not that I'm aware of, and they're profoundly dangerous. Of course, there aren't as many shake shingle roofs as there used to be, but there's still
That's
plenty of them out
them out
there.
Over the last 30 years.
It's interesting to me some of the communities that actually still have shake shingle roofs. Woodside is one that comes to immediately to mind. It's amazing they're still out there.
Well, the issue here, and I'm going to try to be real clear with what I just said, is that when you use the word bottle rocket, to me a bottle rocket is an illegal firework and is prohibited by the state anyway. Mm-hmm. If you say they can no longer discharge any firework, that includes safe and sane.
Mm-hmm.
That includes the fountains you set out in your driveway. It includes the
sparklers.
One of the things we do try to encourage is the use of commercial displays. Because commercial displays are done under very controlled conditions and have a fairly good safety record.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that, we're going to come up to our next break. When we come back, we're going to talk about your website, Table Talk, on KZSB AM 1290, visiting today with former Fire Marshal Chief Ronnie Coleman. Ted Adams, Mike Williams, we'll be right back.
Hey, folks, welcome to the last segment of the show. I'm Ted Adams. My coach is Mike Williams. On Community Alert tonight, today, we're talking with Ronnie Coleman, who's a California State Fire Marshal, retired, been pretty much covering that job in the last hour. And
yeah.
Mike.
Well, let's put a plug out for the California State Fire Marshal's office. Their website, osfm.fire.ca.gov. That's OSFM for Office of State Fire Marshal. www.fire.ca.gov. And a lot of what we were talking about today, all information available up there, lots and lots of downloads and information available. But let's get into talking about cafsti.net/tabletalk. Ronnie, that's your new website. That's where you're posting all your writings and research. Tell us a little bit about that.
Also, can I make a brief comment about what you just said about the fire marshal's office?
Sure.
I'm not speaking for Tanya Hoover, who is the current fire marshal, and I'm responding to these questions. I'm the retired fire marshal, and I'm about to get the wrong impression. I'm speaking on their behalf.
I should have noted that. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, when it comes to, you know, first off, I'm really old. Matter of fact, I look in the mirror every day, and I wonder what happened to that young guy that I used to greet every morning, and somehow or other he's evolved into some old guy. And the process of doing that has forced me to kind of look around and see what I'm going to do with the work that I've spent most of my life doing, and that is writing articles for magazines and publications and textbooks and so forth. So a while back, I came up with the idea of doing something where I could put this stuff up and make it available so that other people could either use it or read it or review it or whatever, because I get quite a few requests for copies of my columns and copies of the stuff that I've done. So we've created this website called Table Talk, and it's based on an assumption that I've been making for a good 50 years of my life, and that is more things happen around the dining room table than happen in the training room. So we kind of allude to the fact that this is a conversation between me and others, and we're posting copies of documents. Literally, there are legacy factors that I've worked on, including some of the research I've done on sprinklers and work that I've done on high-rise firefighting, things of that nature. And we've got this new website where people can log on to it, and if they so desire, they can download and use the material for their purposes, such as a workshop or a training program for their fire department. The only thing that we're requesting back from them is proper notification of where the document came from, copyright recognition. And we'd like to hear from people that do use the stuff, you know, finding out, was it helpful, was it not helpful, and that sort of thing. That's kind of the generic thing. The best way I describe it is it's just kind of like looking into my closet and seeing everything I haven't thrown away.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the site we have all the books you've written, which is 21 or 22 different books, all of which are still available in one form or another through Amazon.com. You can go down, pull up the book, click on it, and it'll take you to those. There's over 200 articles, at least that right now, with more to come, which represents, 35, 40 years worth of writings? Somewhere around there. And then we've also got the Table Talk interviews, which you and I have done throughout the state at various fire stations, and those are also on there. And we've also got some of the Community Alert and some other odds and ends. There's quite a bit of material there for anyone that's a student of the fire service or wants to know more about the if and why things are. This would be certainly a good place to go.
Well, I've talked to a lot of people about it since we created it. I always tell everybody that it's sort of like an electronic file cabinet. We just filed everything away so that they can have access to it if they need it.
Mm-hmm. And it's all there for free. And again, that website, cafsti.net/tabletalk. And there's also quite a bit of audio on there, as well as a couple of video links.
Right.
Well, any closing thoughts, Chief, as we come to the end of another chapter of Community Alert?
No, I always, when I'm given the opportunity, would like to encourage people to be much more fire prevention oriented in a time and place in which major emergencies are capturing our attention. I love fighting fire much as the next guy did, but I've dedicated most of my life to the prevention side of it for the very simple reason that you don't have to apologize for anything when you prevent a fire. But if you lose somebody's home, you lose somebody's life, you lose a neighborhood, there's apologies enough to go around. And therefore, my focus on fire prevention is not being, what's the word I'm looking for here? It's not that I've walked away from the fire suppression side. It's what makes fire suppression safe.
And with that, we're at the end of Community Alert. Thank you for listening. The news is next on KZSB AM 1290. See you next week.
Community Alert is produced by the Wildland Residents Association, San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department, with funding provided by a grant from the Cooperative Fire Program of the U.S. Forest Service, Department of Agriculture, Pacific Southwest Region, through the California Fire Safe Council, with additional funding provided by the Fire Services Training Institute. The views and conclusions contained in this program are those of the hosts and guests and should not be interpreted as representing the opinions or policies of the California Fire Safe Council, U.S. Forest Service, the U.S. government, or this station. Any mention of trade names or commercial products does not constitute their endorsement by the California Fire Safe Council or the U.S. government. Commercial use or rebroadcast is prohibited. For further information, call 805-964-7194 or visit wildlandresidents.org. Technical assistance provided by Richard Dugan, Jim Williams, and Mark A. Ward. The WRA and this station are equal opportunity providers.